Welcome to Shut Up and Ride, and I'm going to say it for the first time on a new pod, sponsored by Charles Owen. Just, it feels good. It feels good to be saying it. I have at the moment Simon Grieve. Simon, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Jenny. How are you?
I'm all right. We've got no Benji today because we have just finished recording a pod with a very special guest. I'm going to let you say who it was, Simon. Who have we just recorded our podcast
it's
with?
It's been some eventing talk, so it's not really Ben's thing, but I think he's really missed out. We've been talking to Laura Collett, our Olympic medalist, gold medalist.
Oh my God. And we've just recorded it. It does kind of drop out a little bit. Her Wi-Fi was a bit dodgy because she was in the lorry. I'm not going to say too much, but I think... Oh, I don't want to slag anyone off, but I think this has been one of my faves.
It's been very, very good. Really, I mean, the only thing with it is that I've had so much more stuff that I could have asked her. But it was just brilliant. And she was really, really interesting. And she was a great, great crack.
Yeah. And we just discovered she's a loner who likes to drink gin. She's going to hate me for saying that.
Those were her words, just so you know.
They were her words. She said it just after we hung up. So I thought I'm going to throw that in there. But... please listen to all of it. There's highs, there's lows. I nearly cry. We laugh a lot. But it's just brilliant, isn't it?
Really, really good. She was fantastic.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's launch Laura Collett on Shut Up and Ride. Oh, I'm a bit excited. I'm very excited. I know I get excited a lot, but I'm going to have to open this podcast with swearing because Laura fucking Collett's on the podcast.
Yay.
My good God, you have spared time in your gold medal winning schedule to come on our little podcast. Obviously, Simon's here as well. Yay, Simon.
Yay for me.
Welcome to the podcast, Laura. How the bloody hell are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. I'm actually, you made out like I'm really busy. I'm actually at Otherton with one horse, so I've been sitting around doing not a lot all day.
So you're basically on holiday.
I am. I'm actually having a lovely time catching up on some sleep. But yeah, it's all good.
It's completely different to if I was competing at Osberton. I'd just be a nervous wreck in a lorry and like constantly throwing up and having nervous wheeze, and you're having snoozes and chilling out.
Catching up on documentaries, and yeah, it's all good.
This is what I want to know. What documentary are you watching?
I actually just watched, it's called A Confession.
started watching that.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. It's a bit messed up about murders.
We like messed up.
Yeah. So yeah, I smashed the whole thing out actually today, which is a bit tragic because clearly... I've had absolutely no shoes today. I've walked the course and ridden, which took all of about an hour and a half of tops. The rest of the time I've done watching TV.
So which horse have you got there?
I've got Benny, who is Colossary Captain, doing his first ever 3-day event. So he's actually quite excited to be here, which is good.
And is he doing the two or the 3-star?
He's doing the 3-star long.
Oh, cool.
Oh, nice. I just love the fact that Laura Collett loves a bit of a crime murder documentary. Do you watch horror films as well? Are you like one of those weird, weird people who enjoys a horror film?
Yeah, a little bit. I go from one extreme to the other. It's either like weird things with a lot of murder and weird stuff going on, or chick flick. There's no real in between.
Or Emily in Paris.
Oh my Confession.
God. Yes, love that.
Confession is like, it's kind of, it's real life though, isn't it? It's like, it's based on true events, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's it was actually where I used to live around in Lambourne. So like all the, when they're driving around all the roads and stuff, I was like, oh, used to be there.
I love it.
Yeah,
oh,
see, I like those. Like, there's one about Jeffrey Dahmer, which is obviously a true thing. And that was really, really dark. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, love.
I couldn't watch that weirdness. When he went to go and murder the deaf guy, I had to turn it off. I got too scared. I couldn't cope with it anymore because it's real life. And I don't know. I don't know if having kids has changed me. I watched a program on Madeleine McCann now, and whenever I go in a supermarket, I'm say to Delilah, "What would you do if someone picked you up?" She's like, "Kick, scream, and bite."
Good girl.
Well. Yeah.
Now I've got a podcast, gone from a podcast to getting my Netflix recommendations. I'm actually going to go and watch that tonight. So delighted. So my first question to you, apart from what do you watch on Netflix, Laura Collett, is why are you so fucking good at eventing?
Very good horses.
See, I said to Simon, I'm going to ask her that question, and I bet she says it's because she's got very good horses.
Yeah.
See, right. You are astronomically good. There is no denying it. Your results speak for themselves. I've worked with you millions of times. You are bloody good. But I was asking Simon this question as a fellow person who rides herbivores at fast speeds over big fences. And Simon, why is she so good? Because you see it from a fellow competitor's point of view.
I mean, I was saying to Jenny earlier that the first time I ever heard of Laura, was I worked for Sarah Cohen, who was a top event rider back in this, still does ride a bit, but not as much, probably about 20 years ago. And I was working for her, and she went off to go and be a kind of chef to keep team support for a competition. And she came back, and I remember her saying, I said, oh, did you have a good time? She said, yeah, I had a great time. There was this one girl that was there that is so good. Like, she's just so good. And I don't know how old you were then, but it's a long time ago now. And ever since, that's when I first heard of you, and she was right. You know, it's followed through. And I think there's a real natural talent there, isn't there?
That's so funny. So that trip was amazing.
I think she led you astray a bit, didn't she?
Totally. Like,
that was her job.
Yeah, I got sent off with Custy as a chef to keep. I mean,
it was a terrible idea.
Terrible, but so great. we had the best time. She taught us how to do shots. And she ended up swinging from the rafters. She taught us what... sadly, eventing parties aren't quite the same as they used to be, but she taught us how to party like a proper eventer. We had an epic time, and it was lots of laughs along the way.
Interesting though how it's changed, doesn't it? Because it did used to be like that. Every event you'd go off and you would be from like swinging from the rafters, everyone taking their clothes off and it's definitely not like that now. It's definitely calmed down a bit, hasn't it? Like
it has,
when you're competing.
It's definitely not quite as fun as it used to be. I remember back in the day, every 3 day you went to, you were out partying and drinking
you shouldn't.
Doing things you definitely shouldn't be doing. And now very much find myself just sitting in the lorry. Not leaving.
Watching Netflix.
Maybe it's because our lorries are much fancier now and we can just stay in nice warm lorries. Yeah, it's definitely not what it used to be. Even the legendary Buccalo parties, like, they're still good, but they're not what they used to be.
See, I worked on the Global Champions Tour, which I'm sure everyone knows about, show jumping. And I was with Michael Whittaker, sat at the bar, having a drink with him afterwards. And I said to Michael...
Are you having a cup of tea, like, having now?
Yeah, definitely. Michael Whittaker was a fan of a cuppa, definitely not a cup of tea.
No.
And I said to him, so what's changed in show jumping, Michael? What do you think of this Global Champions Tour malarkey? And he was like, Jenny, more money, less fun. Pretty much sums it up. Why is that? Do you think you've grown up and the party, you're just not getting invited to the parties anymore?
Potentially. Far too boring these days. I just don't think they happen like they used to. Because even if
you've got the young guns coming up behind you, they want to stay sober so they can try and beat you.
They're very boring these days. Because you used to, where if you did venture out or in the recent years, decided, yeah, come on, let's go, let's not be boring. And you go out and you're like, well, there is no party.
Well, the thing is, like, you could walk through the lorry park back in the day. You could walk through the lorry park and there would be a party going on someone's lorry and you would be welcome to just turn up and pitch in and just, you wouldn't even know who they were. You could just whiz in there and have a great time. Maybe I'm missing that now because I'm old. I don't know.
Well, but... I think people just take life a bit more seriously now, which is really sad.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's true.
Because there's not much more money involved, is there? It's not like the show jumping world where there's the Global Champions Tour is suddenly... I mean, that was a little bit where kind of eventing wanted to go, wasn't it? Change the model, do what they've done, bring in more cash. I don't feel that's really happened. It's not like you guys are now riding out there for £500,000. You're still riding for a bucket and a rug.
we're still riding for a hoof pick if we're lucky. I mean, it's definitely not down to money. I don't know. I think, everyone's just boring these days.
We're all dull. We're all dull.
Which is really sad, because I definitely used to ride better and was far more successful as a young rider when I clearly did drink and ride potentially a little bit half cut. And the results, results were much better. I was much better on a final day show jumping with not a care in the world and feeling very chilled and relaxed. And now I feel like we have to be a bit more serious, and it's not quite as easy or as fun anymore, is it?
You say your results haven't been as good as when you were half cut riding around a cross country course, but yet you now have quite a few Olympic medals under your belt. Let's talk about Paris. So I've got loads of questions. How different was the pressure going in? Obviously, Tokyo, it was, hadn't won, I'm a journalist, I should remember, was it 56 years they hadn't won a bloody gold medal? Something like that. You got into this champions. Was that get your pants that you can't soil, or was it we can do this, we've got extra confidence? Because I'm not sure in my head which one of those I'd feel.
I mean, the thing is, there was an awful lot of pressure going into both, because on paper, both teams were unbelievably strong. Tokyo, we had 3 5-star winners on our team. And both times for Tokyo and Paris, the level and the stress of the competitions leading up to just getting selected, it was like a war to get those three places. So just the fact that you had been given the opportunity to go, and not only was there the pressure of trying to produce a good result, but basically not make it look like they'd made a mistake in the selection, because you knew that there were an awful lot of other people at home that were going to be sat there very quickly to go, I should have gone, not you. Like, so
I think not die of COVID. That was a kind of pressure as well. Like, don't get COVID, don't die.
Yeah, I mean, God, that seems like a lifetime ago. But I remember being all the way through the whole COVID thing, being very relaxed and chilled about the whole thing. So I was like, you know, work outside, it's not really going to affect me, and da da da. And then it was about, well, I think we had to start testing 2 weeks before we left. And suddenly, when it meant that there was an Olympic Games riding on whether you could or couldn't get COVID, because you had to officially test 2 weeks out and the whole way then through. So suddenly I became obsessed with not leaving the house and not seeing any friends and not literally not going anywhere near anybody, because I was like, if I can't go to an Olympic Games because of this stupid disease, I'm going to be savage. So I went from not really caring, being very blasé, to a complete like crazy person about it. And all my friends are like, oh, can we come and see you and say good luck? I was like, no, don't come anywhere near me, I don't want to see anybody. And luckily they understood. So it was all that to deal with. And I remember the horses had left, because obviously they had to fly before we did to Tokyo, and then there were all these like news flashes coming up saying there was a chance the Olympics might still get cancelled because of COVID. And I was like, my horse is the other side of the world. You cannot cancel the Olympics now. There was all of that as well. But yeah, I don't know. I couldn't really say which one felt like it had more pressure. I guess on a personal,
they must have been so different. They must have been such different preparations.
Completely different. And like we had a week's quarantine before Tokyo and then a week out there to acclimatise before the event started. Whereas Paris, we had no training before, no, like we literally just left our yards, arrived in Paris, had a day in holding stables, and then it was into the competition and bang, 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 competition done, home again, all within a week. And it was like a whirlwind. Whereas Tokyo just felt like it dragged, like it was 3 weeks, it felt like 3 months. And all of the, you know, the extras that went with that were just completely out of context of what you normally go through and what you're used to. So there was all of those things. I mean, it's completely incomparable, the two events, even though both were Olympic Games. It was completely different scenarios.
What I find completely nuts is both teams that went to the Olympics, our reserve was the current world champion.
Yeah, I mean, mind-blowing.
That just blows my mind. That's how good, but also how tough to make that selection and go, do you know what? We've got these guys and we've got the world champion, but we're going to put the world champion as reserve. No pressure, Laura. World champion's reserve. You've got to go in front.
Exactly.
That just blows my mind. Don't become world champion is the moral of that story if you want to get on the team for the Olympics.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's been unprecedented the last however many years of the quality of Team GB horses. I mean, it's a privilege to be in as part of Team GB, but it also can be an absolute nightmare because, like you said, you can be the reigning world champion and you're a reserve for a championship team. You know, that's the level, and that's what it's so reliant on current form. You can't rest on your laurels because there's always somebody else going out there banging out results left, right and center. So you have to keep making yourself relevant and probably ending up running your horse more than you like would really want to, just to get a place on a team.
Did you stick to your plan right from like at the beginning of this year? You must have had a proper plan about what you were going to do to try and make yourself be like, you know, irresistible and have to be selected.
She's riding around in just a bra. That's
yeah,
it.
They'd love that.
I think they'd all run a mile if I did that.
Did you change your plan at all, like through the, or did you stick? Was it a seamless plan? You did everything that you thought you were going to.
Yeah, actually, I did. It took a long time to come up with a plan because you get given no guidance. They won't give you anything in respect of what do they want to see, what's going to...
Really?
Yeah, because they don't really... Because they've got so many people and they don't want to, you know, say one thing and then not be able to kind of choose who they want to choose, I guess. So it's very much row your own boat and hope you make the right decision. So I'd very much made my decision not to do a spring five star because I personally didn't think it had any relevance to what you were going to get at the Olympics. And I also thought that if you were doing a five star in the spring, you were putting all your eggs in one basket for one result. Whereas if you went down the four star short route, you could run more often and try and have more opportunities to prove yourself. Plus, I looked back to Tokyo and we were forced into running like that because of there being no spring 3 days because of COVID, and actually felt like it did prepare the horses really well, running them competitively in four star shorts and knowing what it was like riding round the Olympics in Tokyo was basically a long four star short. And we knew that was going to be the case again in Paris. So I just felt like that was the right decision. And it all seemed to be going well until Tom and Yaz went to Kentucky and Oliver and were first, second and third. And now suddenly it was
shit.
Great.
Well done, guys, but thanks a lot.
Yeah, well,
yeah, see, I didn't even even register to me. In my head, you were on that team. For me, I do fangirl, you know that, you and Laura Kraut, like my two favourite Lauras. But for me, I obviously watched Kentucky and I was like, fucking hell, we're brilliant. But it didn't even occur to me that might have put pressure on you because I just thought, she's a given.
Shame you're not a selector, really, isn't it?
I should be, Laura. Yeah. I think
I think the thing is we all knew that there was only one person that was guaranteed a place on the Olympic team, and that was Roz after her results last year, and just the fact that her and Walter are, you know, unbelievable. So fundamentally you're then saying, okay, there's actually only two places And there's about 8 people that are currently fighting for 2 places. So it then became the, I can't even remember, I'd done Burnham Market before Kentucky. So I felt like, oh, good, I've got, you know, a foot in the door at Burnham Market. And then they go and do that in Kentucky. So suddenly that door felt like it was closed in my face. And then I think I went to, I don't even remember the next run, Bicton maybe, managed a good result there. And that felt like so much pressure because Roz had Walter there and that was the only time she was going to run him competitively. So it was like, if I can go and be somewhere near her, then that puts me, you know, gets me a little bit in. And then my plan had always been to go to Le Moulin because I felt like that was the only event that actually held any sort of resemblance of what you're going to get at an Olympics, with the fact that dressage and show jumping was on a surface, you show jump after cross country, and the track's flat and twisty, and the time's always quite difficult to get there. So that had always been my plan all along. And then Yaz and Tom decide to go to Le Moulin as well. So then it suddenly becomes like a proper bum fight for, again, 2 places. And then Kitty had won Bramham the week before. So she's then put herself out there. And so it's like so much pressure. And obviously Le Moulin was going really well until Dan did an overreach and decided it wasn't in his best interest to show jump on the last day. So then it was like, I've done all I can do, but I don't think it's enough because Tom and Yaz go and finish first and second. And it just, yeah, I mean, the whole year has been like a roller coaster of emotions. Just before you've even had selection, you feel exhausted and mentally drained, and you haven't
super
even
stressful nervous energy and stress energy is so exhausting, isn't it?
It's been mad, and the whole way along you genuinely have no idea what they're thinking, what the selectors are thinking. And I mean, the only thing that I sort of could say to myself was, I've genuinely done everything I can do. If it's not meant to be, it's not meant to be. I couldn't have done any more. I couldn't have changed the outcome of him picking up an overreach at probably the worst possible time to pick up an overreach. But you know, it was, by that stage, it was then out of my hands and I couldn't do any more. Sit and wait, hope for the best.
And you obviously have a really good, you have a good team behind you. And like, so like, you made this plan of what you were going to do. And did you make that plan completely on your own? Or did you have advisors because that helped you with that at all? Or did you make the plan yourself?
Obviously, like, has a lot of people to talk to and discuss options. But yeah, I'd say it was kind of, that was my gut feeling and that was my plan, and
yeah,
talking it through just kind of reconfirmed that. And yes, there were a lot of outside, you know, ifs, buts and maybes, but that was from sort of January time, that was always my plan, and plans don't often come off. And you know, I was like umming and ahhing about whether to run him at Burnham Market, because sometimes ground can be quite hard there, and actually the ground ended up being good. So it was like, let's get that result in the bag so that if, you know, if the ground isn't great at Bicton, you've already got a result in the bag, because otherwise you're chasing your tail and you're not giving yourself those opportunities. So yeah, we ended up being able to run at all the events we wanted to run at, and the only thing that slightly didn't go to plan was not being able to finish Le Moulin. But he'd put in an amazing cross country round and proved, like, for me, the one thing he didn't need to go and do was jump another round, show jump on the last day. He's done that enough times. They know.
Yeah, he's proved that so time and time and time again, hasn't he?
He's got with that. So I kind of just had to hope and pray that they'd remember how many rounds of show jump he's jumped on the last day and things like that. But you still don't. You know,
really good as well on a last day show jumping. Like, there is a monumental amount of eventers, no offense guys, who have a monumental ability to fuck it up under pressure on a final day, but you always seem to just hold. Like, I don't think I've seen you not look cool and calm and just keep to your rhythm and ride. Like, you are very good.
You've obviously not looked very closely.
She practices a lot.
I don't watch many of the 4 stars, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I know. It's yeah, definitely don't feel cool, calm and collected. But yeah, like I said, I have good horses. Cover
so
up.
So who made the phone call? Who told you that you'd been selected? And that must have been an amazing moment.
Yeah, so Dickie gets that job. Poor Dickie,
that's a cool job.
Well, you say that. It's cool. It's a cool job for three people or four people. You didn't actually get told the team until later on. I definitely, the way he was quite flustered on the phone, I feel like he'd done all the negative phone calls and not so good phone calls first and left the easy ones to the end. And I think he just wanted to get through them as quickly as possible.
He was just relieved.
He's like the Simon Cowell of the horse world. Does he do a pause before he tells you? Does he go, okay,
yeah,
Laura?
Actually, like Tokyo, I remember the Tokyo phone call far more than the Paris phone call because, like, we'd been told what day we were going to get the phone call and I literally was all day looking at my phone. When's it going to ring? When's it going to ring? When's it going to ring? And then when he did call for the Tokyo one, he was so slow and I was like, just it out. Like, come on. He's like, so congratulations. You are selected for the Olympics. And I was like, sorry, what? Because I literally like played it through in my head so many times. Like, how would I react if it was good news? How would I react if it was bad news? Like, you know, and I was like, oh, you know, this is like, this potentially could be like the moment I've like been waiting for. And I just so was not cool about it. And I was like, what? And he was like, you're going to Tokyo. And I was like, really? And I was like, that's so not how I imagined that playing out. But yeah, I definitely don't think I was any cooler for Paris either. I think it was fairly similar. I think I just was like, oh wow, oh right, thanks. So yeah, I'd love to know. I think Dickie needs to like record us all. I want to know how everyone reacts to it because I definitely did not react how I wanted to react. And it all, yeah. And then you put the phone down and you think, oh, that I did not know. That was not cool.
Did that phone call actually just happen?
Yeah, exactly. Did that actually just happen? And it, to be fair, after when I got the Tokyo phone call, I just burst into tears. I was jumping a load of babies at Hyde Rectory Farm and I'd literally stopped dead because my phone rang and was like, got to answer this. And then I just got on the phone. I was literally shaking and burst into tears. And the girl that was with me was like, is everything all right? And I was like,
oh, bad luck, mate. Bad luck.
I'm going to Tokyo. And she was like, what? So yeah, it was all a bit crazy really, but very cool.
I also love the fact that after Tokyo and after Paris, the other riders, after winning their medal, I don't know, maybe they just don't share it as much on social media. I mean, Tom just seems to be a work ethic, back to work, back competing, and you are as well, but then you also go and have a bloody party and like properly, you are out. Like, there is no holding back. It's just brilliant.
Well, there's so many shit days in what we do. If you can't enjoy a good day and celebrate it and make the most of it and make memories, then what do you do it for?
I see, that's such a good response. I like that.
Yeah.
So true. It's so true.
I was gutted I wasn't there for this party. I'm just gutted. It looked like a really good one. It looked like the best yet. I was like, I'm not in England.
I don't know. I think the badminton one is probably the best yet. This one was close, but yeah, I think it was.
Upped the ante. I remember the gold party was in a barn, but now, like, the parties are taking on their whole new... You get party planners, you've got tents going on. They seem to be growing. You're going to have your own, like, Laura Fest by the end of it.
No, well, yeah, I have very, 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 very good friend, Becky, who took on the job of being party planner, and I was like, yep, you crack on. I'm more than happy for you to do that. And she's pretty epic at organising parties, and I just... turn up basically, and everyone thinks that I'm really cool at throwing parties, and actually it's nothing to do with me.
You're just the reason for it.
Okay, so a lot of people who listen to our podcast follow us because of Ben Atkinson, who's also a fellow podder on this. So wouldn't be so au fait with the eventers. So who in the eventing world, this is important information, is the best and worst dancer and who's the worst behaved?
I'd say Jay Hallam probably falls into all three of those categories. He's kind of the best dancer. He's also the worst dancer. And he's definitely the worst behaved.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think we can all vouch for that. Yes.
Yeah. And it's quite funny because actually I've had a theme. So for the badminton party, I mean, for the first party, it was very tame and had a gold theme and everyone dressed up really smart and it was great. And then Jay rocked up in these gold blingy rapper style clothes, but he was fairly devastated because he was going for being the most outrageously dressed, but he got picked by Harry Wallace, who is an absolute hero when it comes to fancy dress. So Jay was pretty devastated with that, and then he got some very cool, had festival vibes for the badminton party.
I loved that party. That was so cool.
Yeah, I think that was my favourite theme, and people went very out there. But yeah, Jay got outdone. I think we decided the best dress was Adam, Tom's groom Adam, who came in like a full gold sparkly tailcoat and dressage top hat and breeches. So that was very cool. He is, but I do think Jay probably topped. I don't even know what he... So we had superheroes this time. And God knows what Jay was. I don't even know, but he was just a hero for being totally outrageous. He had a
just wig. Just himself.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, there were some really fun outtakes of superheroes at the party. So that was, that was really good.
So after you got your selection call, and then obviously then you went off to Paris. And I kind of wanted to ask you about, so obviously what happened with Charlotte Desjardins in the run up to the Olympics put our sport through the ringer a little bit. It was a really dodgy time for us in general. Did you feel any kind of pressure, extra pressure because of that, to to do your best for the sport as on a wider playing field than just the equestrian lot, if that makes sense?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously it all fired up literally the day before we were going to be out there doing our thing, so there was a huge amount of pressure wanting to actually show what our horses mean to us and the relationship that we have with our horses, and not to let all of us get dragged down by one person making a huge mistake and not getting, having a huge cloud over everybody, the whole kind of equestrian community as a whole. And that was, it turned out like it actually turned out to be an awful lot easier than we had anticipated, because our horses all went and performed like amazingly well. So our first interviews and our first, the press hounding us about all the Charlotte incident and everything, it was so easy for us to just turn it round and say, actually, can we just focus on how insane our horses are and what they've just gone and done? And they don't do that, if they're not happy horses. You just actually had to look at them and look at what they'd done to realize that. So kind of the horses did the talking for us, really, which was exactly how it needed to be. And from that moment onward, after dressage day, it felt like it was almost put to bed quite early, because we could then say,
I thought that you totally nailed it, didn't you? Like you nailed the most amazing dressage test, like pretty much straight away, and that literally, that was the best thing that you could possibly have done.
Yeah, exactly. And like to be able to then just actually say, can we focus on, we're here to do a job, and our job is, we're event riders. So, and again, I guess it was easier for us because it wasn't totally directly related to us, because obviously Charlotte being dressage and us being eventers, it was easier to divert away from that than it would have been if the dressage team had been the first team up. So in that respect, it definitely made it easier. And just the way it all planned out with us having such a good result and then the jumpers going and doing what they did, being completely, you know, almost outsiders really, to go and win team gold. By the time the dressage lot went, everything had definitely quietened down. And then they went and produced a result that was never expected off the back of what had happened. So it kind of was the dream outcome for everybody, for all three teams. And it was just what equestrian sport needed at the time.
Were you guys, I might be completely wrong at this, but weren't you the first gold for UK of the whole Olympics as well for Team GB? So that kind of helped as well. Like, by the way, not only do we love our horses, but here's a fucking gold medal, Team GB, in your face kind of thing.
Yeah, we got told that. I think we only made that by a couple of minutes, but we're still claiming it because we did get the first gold for Team GB. So yeah, that was another huge thing, because obviously you get even more press because we were the first team, you know, the first gold of Team GB for Paris Olympics 2024. So just clawing back the positive media rather than all the negative stuff that had come out, you know, a few days earlier.
Yeah, because you guys, absolutely all of you, deserve a massive pat on the back for what you did there. Like, you did so much good for not just eventing, but for the whole of equestrianism because of what had happened. Like, it couldn't have been better. Good on you.
Well, we actually recorded a podcast saying, is this the end? Because for me, I actually cried watching you guys, because my kids love you, Laura, and they cheer you on, and they're literally, because I'm watching you go, I'm going to be sick, I'm so worried, please be okay. And my kids are literally screaming at the TV. And I had my husband, Gregor, who you know as well, came up and found me sobbing on the sofa. And I get emotional thinking about it now. He said, what is the matter? Laura's gone clear. They've all gone clear. Like, why are you crying? And I was like, it breaks my heart to think my kids might not see horses at the Olympics. Just because we are so invested in the Olympics, every sport, not just horses, but like, to not see you guys galloping around, the thought that might not happen again and how much my children love it just has had me absolutely sobbing. And I think kind of we then spoke about it on the pod, but I think what you guys did, it was about like the passion and how much we love our horses, and you love Tilly, your groom, and just that whole team and that camaraderie and how much joy it brings, like utter joy in our household. And I think like you guys just bringing it home, just, hey, I was still sobbing, but I think it was just the best thing. It just made it all brilliant again.
Yeah, I think it was definitely needed, and the timing of it. And there were so many, you know, throughout the whole of equestrian sports at the Olympics, there were so many stories, there were so many angles, and they were all a brilliant outcome. You know, Mickey winning his however many titles he's now won, you know, he is the greatest we will ever see, and he deserved that title as much as I got very close and can't believe I touched the last fence and all the rest of it. But for me, actually, he was the deserving Olympic champion, and the best man won. For our team to win, having gone in as favourites and off the back of everything that had happened and all of that, there was just, you know, from one story to the next, and it was just what was needed at a really crucial time. And I think huge credit to the French for putting on the most unbelievable Olympics. The venue, like, I'll just never get over, it was a fairy tale from start to finish. You know, you felt like the whole place was just magical. Walking, the first time we walked down into the arena, it just was one of those moments that you really wanted to just bottle up and take with you for the rest of your life, because you can't do it justice talking about it. You had to be there, and you had to witness just what it was like. Like, yes, the pictures look amazing, and the, you know, the footage on camera look amazing, but to actually be there in person, and then you put the crowd in. And we all know the French crowds are loud and crazy, but honestly, I've never ever experienced anything quite like it, from, you know, dressage day to leaving the start box. From start to finish of cross country was like a noise I've never experienced before. And then show jumping day as well, it was like being in a football stadium. I think Adam actually described it the best. He did an interview, and he said the medal, when we walked in to do the medal ceremony, he said it was like being at an Adele concert. And he said we felt like superstars, and it was magical. And it was just what was needed. It was to prove that people love the sport, and people get hooked on it, and people that don't necessarily from one event to the next, and might not even really know what's really going on, what eventing is, or, you know, what the horses are there to do. But you can't help but get obsessed with it and totally get involved in it and cheer on and understand what's at stake and how much has gone into getting a horse to go and do what they do for us. That's what, you know, it all comes down to a partnership at the end of the day, and that's what makes it so special.
Yeah.
So and that cool. Partnership that you've got with London 52 is it's phenomenal, isn't it? But I was saying to Jenny earlier, I was like, where the fuck did he come from? Like, he suddenly like you. I remember because you're so good with your social media. I think I remember seeing him, and I think, oh, that's really nice. But like, where did he come from? Like, where did you find him from? And because I want to find something like that. Where did you find him from?
Trust me, I've been looking for the last so many years to find another one. I haven't found one. I was in Germany looking at young horses, trying to buy a nice, cheap young four-year-old to produce and sell to make some money, because I never have any money. And I think I'd seen about 20 fairly average four-year-olds that I was losing the will to live, because nothing really excited
me. Do you go on your own to do this, or do you go with anybody else?
I think this, I actually can't really remember, to be honest. I normally go on my own, quite like an alone trip.
Insights into Laura Collett. She likes sitting on a lorry on her own now.
Yeah.
And just leaping a lot.
Yeah.
I love being on my own. I'm very antisocial. Basically, I looked at about 24-year-olds that were very uninspiring, and then he was trotting around, and I was like, what's that one? And Peter Thompson, whose yard I was at, he said, oh, that one's not in your budget. And I was like, well, I don't care. What's that one? He said, oh, it's a seven-year-old show jumper that we've just got in to sell as an event horse. And I was like, I want that one. And he was like, but he's not in your budget. And I was like, I'll find a way. Can I try him? Like, is he for sale? He said, yeah, he is for sale. Seven-year-old show jumper. So I basically asked if I could try him, because I really liked the look of him. Jumped him, and that was it. I was like, he's coming home with me. I'll find a way. And luckily had two very loyal owners in Keith Scott and Karen Bartlett, who I said, I think I found my next superstar, but I need your help to buy him because I can't afford him. So luckily they joined in, and the rest is history, as they say.
So with that, when you rode in to go and get your individual medal, how, because obviously you missed out on a medal in Tokyo, sorry, got to say that. And I know that there was a lot of, oh, you've won gold, but you beat yourself up quite a lot, didn't you, for not getting that individual medal. Everyone was thinking that you must be the happiest person in the world because you got a gold, but you are such a competitor. That wasn't actually as easy as people thought. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, that's haunted me for 3 years, basically, knowing that I should have had an individual medal, and I thought I'd never get the chance again. So when I did get the chance going to Paris, it was like, don't mess it up twice. You don't often get a second chance at winning an individual medal at an Olympic Games. So the fact that I was given that opportunity was like, right, come on now, like, you fucked up once, don't fuck up twice. So yeah, it was, you know, it was a huge battle with myself, that had been going on for quite a long time. And it wasn't just Tokyo. It was the World Championships the year after, the European Championships last year, all of which I was in contention for winning an individual medal. And because of something that I did wrong and made a mistake, meant the horse didn't win the individual medal that he so deserved. So going into Paris was a serious redemption mission, really, to try and put right what I'd done wrong for the last 3 years, basically.
I see, but that's just so different, isn't it, Simon, from what public opinion is of, we just see the Babington win and the Olympic golds, and you're there going, yeah, I fucked up. It's just like, it's kind of Insta versus reality, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really hard as well, because I know, like, I've been so unbelievably lucky with everything that's happened, and to have won 3 5 stars on him and everything else has been unbelievable, and all childhood dreams come true. But I guess just the fact that when I was younger and did ponies, juniors and young riders, and I made a plan at the beginning of each year that I was going to come away with a team and an individual medal, and somehow managed to pull it off, it just seemed like that was just what happened, and it was really easy, and you know, if you just dream it, it happens. But reality hit, and seniors has been an awful lot harder, and it's been something that I guess each year that goes by that you don't win an individual medal, then it becomes a bigger thing and a bigger disappointment, and more you feel like you're a failure, and you feel that there's like just something missing, and that you're actually just not good enough to win an individual medal at a senior championship. And yes, you can, you know, you've been able to win at a 5-star, but something just goes wrong at a championship. And that was something that had built up year after year after year, and even more so like in the last 3 years since Tokyo, because up until that point, I was never really truly in a position that I genuinely believed I should be. You know, I had the opportunity to win an individual medal at senior championships, whereas from Tokyo onwards, I was, and something went wrong, and that was just became demons in my head, basically.
And so when you had that fence down in Paris, what went through your mind then? Like, because I know what I'm like when I have a fence down, I'm like, oh, damn it, and I kind of very often lose focus. But you then got it back, and you, what was going through your mind when that happened? Were you thinking, oh no, nightmare? Or were you thinking, no, I'm just going to focus on the rest of the round?
To be honest, in that moment, the relief of knowing I hadn't messed up and that I'd managed to secure a team gold medal at an Olympic Games was at the forefront of my mind. And actually, I didn't know what had happened with anybody else. So I didn't actually know what it meant for individual standings. I didn't, at that point, I didn't realise that if I jumped clear, I would be in the individual gold position, which is probably a good thing, because probably would have put a real dampener on it. I was so proud of what the horse had achieved, and to come out and jump as well as he did. And I actually didn't think he touched the fence. And then I go, obviously, you just whisked away. It all happened so quickly, because you go and do all the media, and then literally we were still doing media when we basically got dragged away to go and walk the course for the next round of show jumping. So it was all happening really, really quickly. And so you're on such a high from the fact that you've got a gold medal. Like, that's amazing. And then I found out that I was still in an individual medal position, granted not gold, but and I just, like, I said to myself right from the beginning, any medal, any individual medal, that's all I want. At this point,
any colour.
At this point, I'm not going to be fussy. So I think I genuinely just, I almost accepted it was never going to happen. And I just sort of was like, right, well, We've come close, which is, you know, this is the closest we've ever been. So, you know, what will be. And actually, I was, after everything that had happened leading up to it, and the fact that he pulled a shoe really early on the cross country, and he was quite sore. And then, you know, the way he'd come out and jumped already, and just everything he'd, you know, everything that he's already done for me, I was like, look, it doesn't matter. It genuinely doesn't matter. I'm just actually, at that point, I was just really genuinely privileged to be sat on him. And when I got back on him for the last round of jumping, it was weirdly okay. I think I'd felt so much pressure overnight going into the team round of jumping, because at that stage throughout the night we only had one fence in hand over the French, and I genuinely had played so many scenarios out in my head overnight. I didn't sleep a wink, and there was never a good outcome for me. It was all, every time it was that I was going to be, by the time I went in, I wasn't going to have any fences in hand, and I was going to lose the team gold medal for the Brits. And that was just how was I ever going to be okay with that? So the fact that throughout the day, each time the French had a fence down, I was like, thank God, that's one more rail that I'm going to have in hand. And so, yeah, it was just like, genuinely, like, I cannot tell you how many emotional roller coasters I went through, from finishing cross country, knowing he'd pulled a shoe, to actually getting on for the final round of show jumping. By that stage, I was like, do you know what, we've made it this far, that's great. I don't really care what happens now. So yeah, and then he went and somehow managed to jump clear, and that was that, really.
Absolutely. How cool amazing. Was it getting that medal round your neck? Like, was that like, oh, holy thank fuck.
Yeah. I mean, I genuinely nearly fell off. Like, the video after I jumped the last fence and realised that I've definitely won an individual medal, I punched the air so hard and nearly toppled off the back. And poor Dan was like, what are you doing? Which was not my finest moment. A little bit traumatised by that. But yeah, standing on that podium was just like so many thank fuck moments. Yeah, basically. Finally.
But I think on a personal note, that medal was so important. Like, as from your friend's point of view and your family's point of view and the people who know you, that's what that medal was about.
Well, yeah, I don't know how they would have coped with me if I had messed up again. I think they were all like, please, please just stay up, fences. Because, yeah, it's hard because you have to put on a front, and you don't, like, after Tokyo, I never ever wanted to sound ungrateful for what had happened, because I wasn't at all. It was just, it's just personal, and it's just things start eating away, and to finally put those demons to bed, it just means everything.
I think one of the real strong points that you've got is your mindset, obviously, like your mindset. And I don't know whether you would disagree with me or not, but you always seem like a very, very strong person. Like, because you've been through the mill like lots of times, like not just recently, like with the Corto Star thing and with the fall that you had, and all, like, you've had to go through some really, really tough bits. Do you think you're a really strong person, or do you think you've had to learn to be a strong person to be able to deal with those kinds of things?
Yeah, I've definitely. Well, so, some things I found easy, like the fall, and that I found very easy, and that was I felt sorry for my family and friends, to be honest. But
you can't see out of one of your eyes. Like,
you can't remember
your
any
eyes.
Of it. That's the thing. That's the thing.
It doesn't work.
I think it's, yeah. Well, they're, like, parts of me are stubborn, very stubborn. Sometimes that helps, and sometimes it doesn't. I would say part of you saying that I have a good mindset would be true, but parts are very not true. But yeah, I don't know. Somehow, I'd say I'm just good at putting on a front. and faking it. Fake it till you make it.
Well, you've definitely made it by faking it, so you're doing all right, mate.
You are. Right, we have taken up an hour of your time, and I think we'll finish why the Wi-Fi is good, because it has dropped in and out of your lorry, and we know you've got some hardcore Netflix to get back to. Who's in the lorry?
Tilly just offered me a cup of tea, and I said, actually, like a gin, please. That's acceptable, isn't it? It's only just gone past 5 o'clock. That's okay.
Yeah, it's perfectly okay.
I think that's a great way to finish the podcast as well. You're going to have a gin and tonic. Yeah. I've got to take the kids to school. Simon, what are you going to have?
I think it sounds like a great idea. I have a gin and tonic as well.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much for coming on. Have you enjoyed it? Has it been the first interview where you've allowed to swear?
Yes, great. Loved it. I just hope you don't edit those bits out. I don't want any beeps over.
No, God, no. No. You didn't drop the C-bomb, so we're all right.
And that's quite controlled for me as well, because that's like the second word in every sentence. So I think I've done really well.
please come back. Please come back.
Will you do another one with us?
Yeah, if I do something relevant enough to deserve to come back on your podcast, then I'll come back.
Drinking gin is perfectly relevant for that, so that's cool. You can come back.
Okay.
Well, I'm back in January, and we're going to do a pub pod. So will you come to the pub?
Oh, 100%. I'm in. Definitely.
Yes! And then you get Jay's coming to it, and we'll have Ben Atkinson there, and we're trying to get him to do it with his top off, which is what everyone wants in life.
Absolutely. Sounds ideal.
Excellent.
Definitely there.
Well, Laura, thank you so much. And as we always end, all that is left to do, in your case, it's shut up and watch Netflix.
Shut up and drink gin. There you go.
Oh, it's best podcast ever.